It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a magic marker. A felt pen.
It's a mistake.
It's a trap.
It's a fucking comedy.
It's quiet. Maybe too quiet.
It's all happening.
It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to talk about movies.
Welcome back. It is a good day to talk to Chris Alina. I am your host, Duncan. Joining me, as always, are Gardner.
Hey, hey.
And Taran.
What's up?
Today we have another interview, and it's a good one. We talked to writer and director Chris Alina, known for his short film Audio Guide, amongst other things, about all of his work. Like I said, the interview was great, and we want to thank Chris for being such a gracious guest. Our audience will remember Audio Guide from our interview with Lee Zachariah, so it was very interesting to get the perspective of the director this time. Gardner, Taran, you want to chime in?
Yeah. I'm going to reiterate that. I want to give a huge shout out to Chris. Thoroughly enjoyed our conversation with him, him taking out the time to talk to us and go really in depth on just so much of his career. We got to pick his brain for over an hour, and it was just so valuable and so much fun for us. And I hope you guys enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed the conversation.
Absolutely fantastic interview. We get to talk earlier stuff, upcoming stuff, some unreleased tidbits that we get to tease you all with. Really just a good time with Chris.
Yeah, we really can't thank him enough. It was, like Gardner said, it was over an hour. It was amazing. He answered everything and more. And Chris, if you're listening to this, thank you. We can't wait to share this episode with everyone. But before we go any further, we do want to do a quick spoiler warning for Audio Guide, the short film. We will be talking about the entire film, so that means spoilers for Audio Guide. If you don't want that spoiled, stop listening now. Go watch it and get back to us. The link to watch it is in the podcast description. So that's your spoiler warning. On with the show. That's all we really have to say. We've gassed up this interview. It's good. You know it's good. You're going to find out that it's good right now. It's here. Listen to it. Our interview with Chris Alina.
Enjoy, bitches.
We are joined now by a very special guest. Writer and director Chris Alina is here with us to talk about his films. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So Chris is known for his short films. He released The Limited in 2016, which he wrote and directed. And he recently directed the short film Audio Guide, which has been winning a bunch of awards at festivals. Our audience will remember Audio Guide, as we've discussed it on a prior episode with writer Lee Zachariah. And Chris also has another short film coming out soon called Refused Classification. That's not at festivals yet, but we're going to discuss it along with all of his other work in this interview today. Chris, how'd I do on that background?
Very good. Thank you. There is a movie in between, but it hasn't been released, so I can talk about that later. Wonderful. I appreciate it.
Oh, that'll be fun to get into. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
it's cool. Machine.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we want to start by asking some questions about Audio Guide. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hot right now. Like we said, it's winning a bunch of awards. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Very surprising. I will say that.
I'm not surprised after seeing it. I'll say that.
Yeah, no, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that.
It's always good when we're like actual fans of the films that we're interviewing, which is we've been really lucky to be able to interview so many people that have made things that we watch and are just kind of blown away by.
Yeah.
So it always lends to a better interview when we're really into the work. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. Oh, that really means a lot. Thank you for saying that.
All of your shorts leave me wanting more. Like they finish, I'm like, okay, like now we're getting into it. And it's
yes.
like
all right, this is the beginning.
And then yeah, I was like, with like, Refused Classification, no. I was like settled in, ready to go. And then I was like, oh no, like I was ready. Like I was like, let's go, hour and a half, ready. But
yeah, the guns are about to come out. Where are the guns in the credits? No. I really appreciate that. Thank you, guys. That means a lot.
So we want to talk about the background a little bit. When we talked to Lee, he told us that you reached out to him because you wanted to get out of your own comfort zone and direct someone else's script, which is what led to Audio Guide. So what was it that made you want to do that?
Yeah, so it's the movie in between The Limited and Audio Guide. There's a film I made called Can You Dig It, which I had written and I'd had in my head for a while. And it was 22 pages. And me being me not having been to film school, and me, I did a creative writing class. I studied creative writing, and I was obsessed with writing long form scripts and trying to get that out there. And then I made Can You Dig It? And we had no money and no time. And the biggest problem with the film is that it was too wordy and it was too long. And I looked at it and went, okay, that's my fault. That's not fault, but it's like, okay, no, you need to know. You need to be a better director to work out that that's too long and that's too wordy. And if that's your words, you need to go to someone else and really fix that up, because the work's going to suffer for it. The performances in that film I love, and I love how he made it and everything, but there's a big problem with the dialogue in that film, and it's too much. So, and then there was a point where I saw Lee's a person I've kind of admired and looked up to for a while, and I became friends with him, and he lives in Melbourne. I'm in Sydney, and we had met at a pub and or a bar, and he was just saying, you know, I've got a bit of writer's block. I can't even write for myself anymore. And then I just said, well, write for me. And I didn't think he'd call my bluff and do it. I really didn't. And he goes, what? I said, yeah, man, you saw the last movie. It's too long, and I need to be a better director. Like, if I didn't go to film school, if I didn't learn how to be a director, I need to learn on the job, and I need that. Like, I really need to rein myself in and go, no. If audiences are going to say that, you need to be the first to pick it up. They can't be ahead of you. And then 3 months later, he came back with a script that he had written prior, but he had tuned it up a bit. And that's when I saw it and said, yep, great. And I don't know if this was intentional, but the lead doesn't say a word. And I'm like, oh, Lee, I now know what you think of my dialogue. Thank you, Lee. and so that was a point where I'm like, okay, good. This is the part where I need to be a better director. This is where you become a director. It's not from the scripts that you write, because I had that thing of like, if it's just me and it's just my writing and it's me as a director, I'm patting myself on the back. I'm not learning anything as I do it. So I need to really work with other narratives, other genres. And so yeah, that's where it came from. That film in between, which no one has seen. And it's hiding in Vimeo on a locked account. But yeah.
Well, if I could just interject really quickly, Duncan, I know you're going to want to get back to audio guide very soon. So this is just a quick aside, Chris, but I'm actually surprised to know that you didn't go to a proper film school. So what was your informal film school? Because yeah. I think I speak for all of us when we say your work looks very professional. It looks like you did study that. So what was your kind of self-study? What did that look like?
Thank you for saying that. That really, really means a lot. It's a little bit of a long story. See, this is what happens when I write my own scripts. I just go on tangents. But I do have I can tell you what happened when I did go to film school. It's a bit of a small story. It might take a minute. So what happened was, I just finished school and I was like, no, I'm going to make films. That's it. I don't care. I don't have a plan B. And if I have a plan B, that's going to sidetrack plan A. That can't happen. So it was between creative writing, where I could learn how stories are told and written, not just in scripts, but other forms. So I can really learn on a grander scale how to notice great writing as well as pick it up myself, or be a director, go to film school. And I was like, all right, let me try film school. So I went to an orientation day, and this is honest to God real what happened. On the way in, there was a guy who was talking to some people going, hey, my parents are paying for this one, but the next thing I study, that's on me. I'm going to pay for that one. I was like, uh-oh, that's a bit of a warning sign. He's not here to be a filmmaker. He's doing this for fun. And his parents are paying for it. And here I am in a torn up T-shirt and red Converse shoes. This is not good. And then the lecturer sits there and he goes, all right, everyone in the room, tell me a film that taught you the mechanics of filmmaking and made you want to be a filmmaker. There are a lot of answers, like The Godfather, Seven, what was another one? A lot of Scorsese. And I'm not against those films. It's not that. The guy that said he was paying for, that his parents are paying for it, said American Beauty. I'm like, cool. Then it came to me and I said Smoke and Aces. If you guys have seen that film, the action film with Ryan Reynolds, Ben Affleck. Have you guys seen that one? No. Okay, it's by the guy who did The Grey. It's an action film and it's, I love it. I love it to bits. And I wanted to say that. And I didn't say it to throw a spanner in the works. I said it because there's things in that film that I think are technically brilliant. And when I said that, someone in the room said, oh, it's a Tarantino ripoff. Oh, he's taking the piss. And then the guy who at the beginning I'd met said, go on, explain that one. And I said, you asked me what film taught me about the mechanics. That's an action film, which people are going to dismiss, but it's got the best color grading. It's got the best blocking because it's an action film. It's all about physicality and bodies in a space. And it taught me how to block that in different ways other than an art film or a prestigious film. And I just talked about that and they all just dismissed it. And then I said, well, what else do you want to do? And I said, I want to shoot on film. I think the look of film is beautiful. I think film should look like paintings and they should look bigger than what we've got on our laptops and our phones. This was in 2010, by the way. So digital wasn't even the forefront yet. It was getting there. And I said, no, I really want to learn how 16 and 35 works. And then the lecturer said, no, film's dead. Film's dying and it should be obsolete. And I got up and left. And I never went back. And I said, all right, you're going to learn writing. And if you're going to learn directing, you got to pay for shooting on film yourself. And you got to get someone who knows it so you can ask them and watch them work. And that's where it came from. The DOP, Kim Vidicus, he's a very close friend of mine. He did all of the films from The Limited. And The Limited is the one where I said, no, we're going to pay to shoot on film. And I learned by shooting on film, because when you shoot on film, you can't rewind, you can't watch it back. You don't have a monitor telling you how everything's looking. You have to trust performance. You have to realize that you don't get 1,000 takes. You only get about 3 or 4 max. And then it teaches you to trust your instincts, trust the people around you. Don't get egotistical and go, oh, no, I know how this works. You don't. And they do. Let people do their jobs and learn how those jobs work so you can all collaborate together. And it got me to work with actors more. So the short answer of it is shooting on film with professionals and just working with them and being open to their process and learning how to work with actors and what my process is as well. Also, as a side note, when they gave me shit about Smoke and Aces, they said, you can come on, give us another film. And I said, Crank 2. And then they all started scoffing. And I'm like, you're snobs. Go away. Crank 2 is great. Should have been shot on film. But yeah. So yeah, it was learning on the spot. But each time I made something, I had to advance it in some way and do something that I hadn't done before or I was lacking on the first time and focus on that.
I love that philosophy. And I think it comes through like I always say, like the look of your films. And I think I don't want to step on your toes, Duncan. We have a question about this, but clearly like shooting on film adds to that like professional look and just sort of this warmth to the picture, you know, yeah. If that's what you're going for, that just gives it a different experience. And I think that's what made these three films that we watched for this interview very special to me. So thank you for that answer. Fascinating.
Thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it with the warmth. That's a big one for me, color and warmth, because a lot of films these days don't have it personally. But yeah, thank you.
So we will get back to Audio Guide, like you said, Gardner, but since we've kind of gone down this path, I want to ask you, we were just talking about the film, and I think you said that you did The Limited on film, but were the other ones not on film then? Or the other ones were also on film?
They were all on film except for Can You Dig It? Because we didn't have the time or money, it was parts of it were shot on Super 16 and other parts were shot on digital, were shot digitally. And in that film, it's a person who's a waiter at a restaurant planting microphones on people's tables, sitting in a corner of the room and listening to those conversations. And the conversations we shot on Super 16 because they had to have a warmth and like a filmic quality to them because they weren't looking at the table, they were only listening. So it was kind of like what they imagined that conversation to look and feel like. And then the other stuff was digital and it didn't quite work. I really wanted it to work. And then I just went back to film. So it's been Super 16 since The Limited, and I've made 4 films since on film. And I made 2 just when I was learning how things work on digital because we didn't have access to film.
Okay, yeah, because they all have, it's got this distinct look that now I associate with your films. So I was, you know, I wasn't sure if you were saying that you had used a different camera for them because I was like, they definitely do look like they've got your style to it. It's like a signature for sure.
Thank you. That means a lot. Yeah, all Super 16. Some have different types of film, like some's day stock, some is tungsten and different levels. But yeah, it's mostly the same camera and stuff.
Very cool. So to get back to Audio Guide, we started off by asking you about writing someone else's script and you kind of gave a really interesting answer about that. Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure that your dialogue was not as bad as, or as long as you say it was. I'm sure it would have played a lot better than you're rating it. It seemed like it did, but I digress. Now that you've said that, and you said that you really did, it seemed like you enjoyed working on Audio Guide with someone else's screenplay. Is that something that from now on you're kind of looking to do that exclusively, where you want to be collaborating with someone else?
I think I do. I think that'd be nice, because there's things in Audio Guide where I did some of the rewrites and Lee was like, no, it's yours. You can do whatever you want. And I was like, no. If I'm doing any rewrites, and some of the rewrites were based on locations, and I was like, no, let's condense a scene and just make it a moment that we can spend some time on instead of splitting it up into different locations. And I did some rewrites, and I added two scenes, but they were minor. In Audio Guide, I can tell you the scene where it's the woman who runs out of the gallery and it's a domestic violence. I think that was me, because Lee had something else in place. And I said, well, the logistics of that will be a nightmare. But at the same time, I need this to be personal. I really need it to be a personal moment. And I need to ground some of this stuff. Not a lot of it, just little bits to make that film feel a little more warmth and grounded and a little bit more personal, because that's my job. That's the job as a director, to make it feel personal and feel more like the audience can connect with it. Because if I didn't do that with Lee's script, then the film is done. It's over. It didn't work. So collaborating with Lee on rewrites, which he was so open to, was really nice. And I've also collaborated with other writers who didn't want to change a thing. And I was like, well, we can't do that. Like, I want to change things that I want to direct. And I love the idea of collaborating with other writers, especially if there are ideas that I've had and we can flesh it out and work on it together. So I think I do want to collaborate in future with other writers, even take their scripts and just make changes with them in the room and them to sign off on it. So it's still their script. That would be good. So yeah, I'm very excited by doing that and seeing where it goes, whether it's something I've partly written or if it's completely them and I'm just making little changes to make it more personal.
So speaking about collaborating on it and adding things, like, I didn't know that you had added that audio guide of the person. So that's interesting. But so when we talked to Lee, he said that, I believe that the pyramids, the assassination, Jack the Ripper, and God were all, those were always there. They weren't like late additions or anything. So was there anything that you would have liked to add if you had gotten, you know, if it was longer? Was there any, you know, those are all pretty interesting things to tell the audience about, but was there something that like maybe it would have been the next thing in if you had a little bit more time?
I want to say, look, before I'd seen it 1,000 times, I would have said, yeah, I would like to have known more about her. It's a woman we've spent so much time with, and I feel it's unfair that we don't get to know her because it's her film. To me, that film's about a woman in trouble and a person who learns about themselves and who they really are, and through a device in a weird circumstance. The device is secondary to me. But now, having watched it 1,000 times, I almost kind of want to say no, because you learn about her without that device telling you who she is. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what I set out to do. But that's just me going, I'd like to know a little bit more about her. Poor thing. How are you going? You've had a rough day. Sorry. That was more learning more about her. In terms of about the world and the universe, I don't know. I think, okay, no, there is an answer for this. If there's a scene, do you remember the scene in the alley where she's going through and Ben, burger wrapper? There's a little line at the end where it talks about a person who was killed for writing about Indigenous deaths in custody. That's something I would have explored on, and I would have wanted, if it were up to me and we had more time, I'd look more at the history of that and have more details in the film about that, because that's a big thing in Australia, where a lot of Indigenous deaths in custody and a lot of that's a big injustice with our system in Australia, and especially in Sydney and the area we shot in. So I would have looked at more of the history of that and included specific moments and things just to make it so it really feels like it's a world that exists and it's real. Because like having Jack the Ripper and all of that makes it fantastical. But if you ground it more in a world that you live in, it makes things feel really specific, and that makes it more personal to me. And also that's something that's not talked about. So to include that would have been big, but I didn't want to have misinformation, or I didn't want to not have the right research. And yeah, that was one for me. I wish I said more about aliens or something exciting, or like Abraham Lincoln, vampire hunter. And I'm like, no, don't do that. Just stick to ground. But yeah, that's my answer, I guess.
If you had the audio guide, mm-hmm. what would you want to know? What would you point it out and try to learn about?
If I keep making movies, and if it keeps going well, and if those movies do well, and what happens from there, the dying part, I'll probably do what she did and go, no, don't worry about that. Let's get back to the good stuff. I would learn how I go further. In my head, I'd be like, no, don't do that. But that's what happens when you get a device like that. You would do it. Curiosity would just get the better of you. And I'd also check on my friends and check on my family and see that their future going forward is pretty good. Not that, and also wonder if I could change it. Yeah. Again, I really should be going. Yeah. Well, I've had a lot of people going, when's Audio Guide the movie coming out? I'm like, that was Audio Guide the movie. No, the feature, the 4-hour film. I'm like, Lee, do you have a 4-hour script handy? No. I'm like, all right, fair enough. All right. We'll talk later. I know some people who watch that going, Chris, why aren't you learning about like where the missing bodies are or how to win the lottery? And I'm like, man, come on, let's be real. You'd make it personal.
Yeah, I mean, there's always those little holes you can poke in something like high concept like that, but yeah. It's really not what the film is about, you know? Yeah. So I think you did well in sticking to focusing on explicitly what the film is about and not getting lost in those details.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
And speaking about what the film is about, you kind of mentioned that it's less about the device for you and more about the story of Audrey and what happens to Audrey. So going off that a little bit, do you consider it a horror, or do you consider it a sci-fi, or do you think it doesn't really fall into a genre?
That's a really good question. It's really good because I've been asked this a couple of times where my friends are like, do you think this is a horror film or a sci-fi? And I'm like, I do. Even though it might not necessarily show it, or it might not put the tropes of that genre on the forefront. All the horror films that I love and the sci-fi films are about those themes and ideas. So to me, it is. I think to me, it is a genre. I think it's a horror film and a sci-fi film and a drama. I think it's those three. They're the big three for me. So yeah, my answer is yes, even though the film may not seem that way on surface level. But a lot of horror fans are really starting to love it, which means the world to me. The minute they know that there's no blood or gore coming up, or they're not stuck in the snow and Kurt Russell's going to have to flamethrow them, they get it. They're with it. Like, because it's those things. It's because I have a theory about horror films, why people are obsessed with them and why they're amazing, is because that's the one genre that looks death in the eye and explores death the most. It's horror. Drama kind of does, but it's more about people processing death, whereas horror is literally about death and how terrifying it is, but also how you can conquer it and really think of death and just be above it and not let it define you. And that's what Audio Guide is to me. Yeah.
It's also interesting to me that you picked three genres that you think defines this picture, and horror fans are gravitating to it. To me, one thing that is so fascinating at why I'm so attracted to horror films is because maybe it's because they're made on lower budgets in general, and they just have a little bit more freedom with what direction they can take the story. But to me, they're like, at least currently, you know, we're not left talking about like slashers of the 80s or whatever, but they can straddle these different genres in a lot of different ways and kind of explore multiple facets of a story and of character arcs that other genres are more constricted by, which to me, I tell people, like, people ask me, what's your favorite genre? You know, when you're into movies, the first question is always, what's your favorite movie? I don't know, I have so many of them. What's your favorite genre? Horror. Why horror? I hate horror movies. You know, Freddy Krueger's terrifying. No. Horror movies are like the most adventuresome films, I would say now, in that they're not afraid to march into new territory.
Yeah, exactly. And I think most horror films are the best films about grief and processing grief, which is what the drama genre is built on. Drama looks at people dealing with grief and sadness and things that affect their life. Whereas horror films do that, but also don't, like you said, restrict themselves. There can be gore, there can be horrible things that happen, which might make the film, but like it, that makes that experience all the more intense. It also can, I'm with you on that. I really think that horror is this thing that is looked upon as low budget, Freddy Krueger, gory, cheap, and I'm like, it's not at all. It looks at the things that those other genres have, but they expand it more and really have a broader horizon. So I'm with you on that. I think so.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to have the trajectory that TV has had, whereas TV at one point was looked upon as kind of like this like cheap medium that there's only trash, you know, and now it's like everyone wants like a prestige television show for their streaming service or something. And it's where a lot of people are saying the best stories are being told. I don't know if I completely agree with that, but you know, it's kind of like gotten into this like golden age. And my fingers are crossed that horror will, as a genre, have a similar trajectory as television.
Me too. And I think, you know what, I know it's a common one, but I think Get Out going to the Oscars, being nominated for Best Picture, winning Best Screenplay. And I think there's a tide turning because 10 years ago, or 15 even, that film would not be nominated for Best Picture. It would be the underseen film that people liked. It did well at the box office, but it had no prestige. And it is. And I think Jordan Peele, I don't know the exact phrasing, but he said only horror could really emphasize the fears and concerns and the anxiety that that film is about and has. No drama would not do that. Horror can. I think people saw that with that film. And also the idea that horror is not restricted to just gore and crass, you know, theatrics. It's also funny. It's also this. So yeah, I think Get Out is a very good start to the idea of horror is more than just cheap. I think that it can be explored more. And even Hereditary is another one too, where Midsommar. I think these are films that people are really, especially academics and people who are like film snobs, like I'm one, but that's true. Like they're starting to warm to it, going, no, maybe horror has something. It's like it always has. Just give it the time of day and give them the money to make a proper horror film. So yeah, I'm with you on that. So I went to this tangent with horror after your genre question, but that's me. I think Audio Guide is a horror film in a lot of ways. So hopefully.
There is a lot of versatility when it comes to the horror genre. One of my favorite movies ever is Scream. And I always struggle with, I don't even know if I consider it, you know, it's like, is it a thriller or is it full on horror? Because it's not like, again, it's not like in the sense of like a Freddy Krueger horror, right? Where it's kind of, that's, it's not like in your face. It's got Ghostface. So it's got a killer in it, but it's not, you know, it straddles the line. And I think a lot of the best horror movies do that. And horror has the ability to do that more so than any other genre. And I guess my question going off that would be, since we're talking so much about horror and genres right now, is there one that you kind of gravitate towards? Because I mean, I'd say that all of your films are dramas. They all fall into that category, but they also all, to me at least, kind of defy a neat placement, if that makes sense, into any one bucket. So I was just wondering if there is a place that you kind of gravitate to when you're trying to decide what film you want to make, or when you're actually in the process of writing it.
Yeah, sure. So sorry, is the question more what's the thing that I gravitate towards when I'm making something away from genre? Yeah. Well, someone summarized it kind of perfectly. A friend who I'd showed Refuse to, he goes, you have this thing of having very big concepts and big ideas, or almost borderline magical realism, but in grounded situations. So my first one is, having a big concept that's fit for a movie. I don't want to see just two people in a room where it's not about much. Not that most films are like that, but I want it to have a great idea. I want it to have a big concept that is just has a different approach to make you think twice about how it would affect, how a person would feel and how they'd be treated in that big scenario. So kind of like a magical realist, over the top, ridiculous concept that on paper shouldn't work, but you just put real people in those scenarios and you care more about those people, so that concept now feels richer and stronger, and it's not just about the concept. So that's my two big things, just having a big concept and a big idea, but then putting grounded people in those scenarios so it feels more grounded, and then letting those characters and their decisions define what the film's going to be in terms of genre. It's always characters, what they say and do first, that tell me what the tone is, and try and juggle tones. I love trying to do that, because it's so hard to do something funny and then something serious and then something horrific all in one moment. And when you have a scene or a film that pulls that off, it's golden. Like, everyone really, there's more discussion to be had afterwards, I think.
I can say you absolutely nailed that with The Limited, because I had to watch it twice. I watched it and I'm chuckling along with these, like, you know, there's just boys being boys. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, this is awful. And and you're in the room with the teacher, and I run it back, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, I was kind of chuckling with them, because, you know, they're, it's like physical comedy. I'm like, no, they're like tormenting this poor lady. That was, yeah, I went through the full range of emotions in like 10 minutes. It was bizarre.
Well, thank you for saying that about The Limited. I really appreciate that one, because that was the first, that's the first proper movie I made, I think. That's the first time I knew nothing going onto that set. I didn't know a thing. And all of us just rocked up, and we did that in 2 days. And that was a script, because I went to a Catholic boys' school. So that's what it was like. Like, that, I was like, no, get the kids right. And then the rest is done. Though you don't have, like, the rest, that's half of the battle. So I appreciate that a lot. That really means a lot. Because that was the first film where I tried to do that. And I just written my own script, and I knew nothing about filmmaking, and I just jumped on in with film. So thank you. I that means a lot. That one, that's a film that's very close to me, because not a lot of people saw it, and it didn't do much in the way of festivals. So,
yeah. Well, and talking about The Limited and the kids in particular, it felt so real, and the performances were fantastic. I mean, where did you find them? Where did they come from? They were really good.
We shot it because I'd met a producer, and we shot it in another state. So I didn't know anyone. I had no idea about actors. And then we went to a acting school, and there were a lot of boy actors, and there were about 12 that we saw. We only got to see 12, and we needed 3. And I picked 6 that I liked and said, okay, we need to split them up and put them in rooms and have them talk to each other. Because the film is their chemistry. If I know that they're all good actors individually, great, but I need to put them in a room and I need to see them talk to each other. Don't give them a script, just let them speak and let's see how that feels. And if it feels forced, if it feels actory, if it feels wooden, then it's not them. We need to then put another actor out of the 6 we've got in that room. And then it came down to that. And it was just, and there were actors too, where they looked like students, like they didn't look like actors, they looked like boys. And I was like, you need that. They need to have a look where it doesn't look polished or actory. So it was the look, the chemistry, and knowing that each individual one could act. So yeah, it was just going to a acting school, and it worked out, thankfully. But yeah, that's how. And that was a learning curve for me, directing as well. Going, okay, actors, chemistry, putting them in a room. If this works, all you need to do is turn the camera on and get them in a right angle.
And you were doing that on film, right? So it was.
Yeah.
We got a couple of takes and
And we had a Steadicam operator who worked on Red Planet, the Val Kilmer film, and he worked on The Matrix. And he was just in Adelaide, and he was sitting around one day, and they asked him, hey man, can you come to this film? And he goes, buy me a case of beer and $100 and I'll do it. And then that opening scene where it's them playing and it's him walking back, that's a Steadicam guy walking back that long pathway. He said that's one of the hardest one takes he's had to do. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You worked on The Matrix. And he goes, yeah, but The Matrix has cuts. And I'm like, oh, fair enough. Sorry. And here I am, this 24-year-old, just going like, go back. It's going to be fine. He's like, Chris, he's quite old, and that steady can't be heavy. And I'm like, just do it.
Man, he's a little buzzed.
Yeah, exactly. And then he was like, and then when he ended, I was like, are you okay? How are you feeling? And he goes, for my case of beer, I'd like this imported German. I'm like, oh, fair enough. I'll get you the imported. I'm not getting you the cheap stuff. So yeah, that was a learning curve. And that scene was just one take. And we did that a few times. And one thing as well I did on that film is rehearsals. Because film takes longer to set up and lighting, it takes like half an hour a scene. It can. I like to rehearse with the actors there. So I did that with them, where I'm like, guys, don't talk about the script. Talk about your weekends and talk about it as mates and you're younger. And yeah.
I'm surprised to hear you talk about your writing. And remember, you were saying the one that didn't come out, you were saying it was overlong, I guess, sometimes in the dialogue. Mm. Because in The Limited, one of the parts that really jumps out, one of the real, where it really hits, is the dialogue and like that chemistry that you're saying they definitely have, but also it's snappy dialogue. It feels like kids talking to each other. Was there, I mean, I know you said that you kind of pulled from your own schooling experience and just kind of how the banter was there, but was there anything else that like helped you in writing that dialogue? Because it really does come across as very organic.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think it's just from my time at school. And I think there's one thing when writing that, it was saying to myself, don't fear about being too crass. That's, you need to be crass. Because when you're at school and you're 16 and you're surrounded by guys, again, Catholic or boys school, there are no girls around. And you don't put a bunch of men in a room for years. You don't do it. And when you do, they're going to talk crass and revolting. But it's going to sound fun because to them it's fun. To them, that's banter. To them, that's a Tuesday. And I was like, you just keep it crass. Not intentionally. I'm like, don't make American Pie, but just when they're talking and they're being crass, don't hold back. And don't, when you're writing it and when they're saying it, don't make it sound like you stopped it from being crass. Just let it happen. Let the conversation flow so it really sounds organic. And it sounds like you are at a school with them. And yeah. So it was about 80% my dialogue and a little bit 20% their improv, where I said, let's get one take with the dialogue that's scripted. Let's see how that feels. And then let's do it again. Add some stuff in. Don't hold back. Really just be upfront. You guys were 16 and you went to school not that long ago. 4K you did. Like, I'm almost telling you to unlearn the things that you have in being an adult, like go back a little. So yeah, it was a small mix of improv and just what was scripted and really just letting it out there and just letting it happen. And also having a story in that and having a narrative purpose meant that I couldn't go on for 100 hours. So it was good to just contain it in that one scene. And yeah.
That's kind of the second time that you've brought up the idea of letting your characters tell you what they want to say, almost kind of letting them take the script where they're going to go. Is that something that has ever been like, you were writing a script and you thought it was going to go one direction, it kind of took it the other direction? Like maybe you were writing audio, or not audio guide, obviously, maybe when you were writing reviews classification or something, you thought it was going to go somewhere, and then one of the characters just was like, no, I need to say this right now. Yeah. Is there ever been a situation like that?
Yes, with a feature that I'm writing and audio, and The Limited. The Limited was, I had a few other ideas on where that would go with the teacher and what the teacher would say to really destroy this kid's mind frame and really throw him off. But as I was writing it, I was like, no, the teacher needs to say something really out of nowhere horrific, that because they're kids and because the stuff that they're saying is horrible, it's the idea of what if you say something that one-ups that horrible, like that, the idea that kids, like these boys, have no kind of limit to what they can say and what they can imagine. Imagine if you give them something that's both that but grounded, like make it the real world. And that's where that went, where I'm like, what is she going to say to him to break him? And how is she going to put herself in that? And how's it going to sound nasty and facetious without that being entirely the intention? She just wants to reprogram him as a person to make him feel how it really feels when you speak to someone. So it was that. I think it was, what's she going to say? How is she going to come across? What are these kids going to say? What's it going to look like when they're in a classroom? That changed. It got nastier as I was writing it. And I had to apply the rules that I did with them as kids, where I'm like, no, don't hold back. Keep going. I'm like, no, this is too nasty. This poor audience. I'm like, no, do it. And that's where I was like, all right, fuck it. I'll do it. How do you destroy a 16-year-old boy who's crass and has no concept of responsibility and consequences? How do you break him? And that's where it came from. And also at the same time, I was like, Chris, you need to make this teacher a character. And I was like, let's just see what she says. So that changed. That got nastier and that got more direct and more cutting. And that's one. And two, when the kid comes back to the classroom and talks to his friends, what does that look like? And I had it as a more them kind of reflecting on what they had said and done, and him trying to tell them a different version of what happened in the classroom. When I wrote it, I was like, no, pretend it never happened. Just make him a different person. He's now changed. The other two are kind of the same. He's not. So yeah, that was a big one. And this new one where I veered more into being funnier I had a serious idea. I'm like, let them talk shit because they sound more like people when they talk shit. And now I understand them as people more. They're not pawns in a concept, which is my big thing. Don't have characters in a film that are part of a concept. Be pawns in that concept. That's a lot of problems I have with films. Let the concept work around them. Let their personality and who they are and who they're going to be at the end of this, let them have a relationship, concept versus character. So.
That's a great point. I see a lot of films, I guess not a lot, but because I don't know. There's times where I watch a movie where I come out of it and I'm like, I don't know, I was entertained, but there was something that bugged me about it.
Yeah.
And then after thinking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, none of those characters had any agency. They were just trapped by their situation. And they just kind of moved along just exactly how you would expect them to. Mm-hmm. And so it's always refreshing. And that's why I love doing this series, because we talk to filmmakers who are not in that mold, who are doing things with characters that are actually interesting, that these characters actually feel like living, breathing people. And I think, you know, as cinephiles, we find that really, really refreshing, because I don't know if it's just the state of the industry or whatever, but a lot of stuff is kind of very paint by numbers. Mm-hmm. And so to get stories like that, just, you know, I don't know. Thank you for for having that consideration of your character. It bugs the hell out of me.
Me too. And I appreciate you saying that, because there's that thing of, I'll just say this quick because I know I love what you said and thank you for that. There's this thing now where anytime you talk about movies, anytime you talk to a filmmaker, superhero films come up, and superhero films, this and that. I am not against superhero films, because the idea of people who work really long, hard hours and have families and things, they just want to go to a film and escape. And I'm not going to shit on films that do that for those people. And it's bringing people to cinemas. We need cinemas to be alive, because Netflix and things, they're not killing films, but it's giving less of a reason for people to leave the house. So superhero films that have big ideas, big concepts, they go along. We do need them in some way, even if I don't like a lot of them. That's my answer to that. But I do have that thing of watching superhero films where I'm like, imagine if these characters just said things that just were specific, because and just felt like people. And then when they're superheroes, it could just feel so wonderful, instead of like, I'm just an ordinary guy. Like, to me, no one's ordinary. No one is. I've never met an ordinary person. There's always, people are too specific for that. And I think it also ties into another thing of specificity is universal. That idea of when you make a character so specific and so something they would say or they would do, it's like, no, I've said that too. Like the more specific it is, the more widely, the more inviting it feels, I think. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, it just gives your characters more life.
Yeah.
I studied screenwriting in college, and that was one of the things that took me longest to learn, was people were telling me, you know, interesting concept, good plot, but your characters all kind of are talking the same way. Mm. And so one thing I did was, when I was writing the script, I would make up voices for them in my head and speak it out loud. And it gives each of them a unique voice. And in that way, you're kind of able to like breathe more life into the character itself. And then by extension, the script and the story itself.
Yeah. And I had the same problem when I was studying creative writing and screenwriting, where I was thinking of the concept too much. It's like, fuck the concept. Sorry.
You can swear. You can fucking swear on here.
Oh, thank fuck. All right. Fuck
the concept. Don't fucking apologize for that.
Oh,
we are also unrated out here. So
yeah.
That's cool.
Fuck yeah. Thank you. Motherfucking thank you. So that's the problem I had, where it was, man, I like this concept. Fuck yeah. And then I'm writing it and I'm like, but who are these people? So I did the opposite. I started writing characters in rooms and situations. And then that's where that idea of just let the characters tell you where this is going. Don't have a plot. Don't have a plot just yet. Plot is putting people in places and making them say things. And would they say that? Would they be in that room? Would they be in that situation? Plot needs to be secondary. Characters need to come first. That's where I learned that at creative writing. And that was why I was really happy that I went to creative writing and screenwriting because it helped. And also hearing other people in creative writing do poetry and novels and other forms of writing, it kind of, you could see how that was a universal thing of like characters need to come first and feel it, and emotions and feelings and specificity are everything, because no one's going to go with you on that plot unless they're there. So yeah, I had that too. And making individuals their own. And yeah, absolutely.
We just reviewed Good Will Hunting and we were praising Damon and Affleck for their banter in that movie as well. Just kind of like how we were talking about your banter in The Limited. Oh, so are there any screenwriters that you kind of, I don't want to say emulate, but kind of you look at their screenwriting, you look at their scripts and you're like, okay, that's the kind of story I want to tell, or I want to tell my story in that kind of way. Is there anyone that you think is, you know, like interesting that, like, I know you're a big Paul Thomas Anderson fan. We haven't really mentioned him yet in the the episode, but yeah. I don't know if there's anyone, like, I mean, I'm picturing Paul Thomas Anderson as a potential answer, but you know what I mean? Like, are there any anyone like that?
There is a filmmaker that I adore, and I'll just say it. Richard Kelly, Donnie Darko, Southland Tales, The Box. And I think Donnie Darko is the weakest of the three, but potentially the best in terms of writing, because Donnie Darko is... I really like the film, but I love the other two more. In fact, I think Southland Tales is one of my favorite films of all time. It might be in my top five, and people loathe it. And I'm like, I don't understand how you could hate that. It's so specific and odd and wonderful. But he's a guy who I like where he's coming from, where it's like, make the characters specific and odd and so out of this planet that everything around them is secondary. In Southland Tales, the world is ending. And the world looks like an MTV episode, which it kind of looks more like now. People said Southland Tales is the closest to reality than anything. But it's the characters. They're so strange. They're so specific and so out where I'm just like, the world ending is almost a joke and it's funny instead of it being this horrible thing. Donnie Darko, the world is ending in 28 days. And you forget that it's ending in 28 days because you're stuck with a kid that you're learning about and how he's interacting with people and what he's doing in that time. It's not, yeah. So that's, I think watching Richard Kelly films was a start for that. And The Box too. I think The Box is incredible. But Paul Thomas Anderson, Richard Kelly, Spike Lee is a big one for me. I love Spike Lee. I think Spike Lee has, his films have a specificity that you can't get anywhere else. Like Do the Right Thing, how that film is just set on a hot day. There's nothing else to it in terms of plot. And then each character defines where the day goes and their hang-ups and their prejudices and their the way they interact and the things that they have on ground on. And that's a big one for me. Spike Lee. And oddly enough, I know this sounds crazy, but Cameron Crowe, I love. I fucking love Cameron Crowe and his films. And these days, Cameron Crowe looks like a big old softy that just doesn't know how the world works. I'm like, no, you're wrong. Cameron Crowe is about people who want to shout from the rooftops that they need a hug. And I'm like, that's wonderful. We need more films like that. And also Cameron Crowe films are about people who just really, in a really sweet, nice way, talk about how they emotionally open up and they need help. And I'm like, great. You don't want to watch a film where you know the character needs help and then at the third act, they're telling you they need help. No, have it from act one. So then we can have a process of how we get to where we need to. And I'm just thinking, who else is in terms of screenwriters? I think Billy Wilder's amazing. I also think Paddy Chayefsky with Network, I think is incredible. And yeah, I think they're the big ones for me. Oh, and sorry, last one I'll give. Nicole Holofcener. She wrote, she's one of the writers in The Last Duel recently. I think her films are amazing. She looks at often women in who are privileged and them looking at their privilege and also them in circumstances where they seem comfortable in theory, but they're not. There's always something wrong with something bubbling. And I think her stuff's great.
Look at that. We got all the way back around. The question started off with talking about Good Will Hunting and we got back to Damon and Affleck property, right? In The Last Duel.
Yeah, this is why I need to have a collaborator with writers, because I will take one question and go, but let's talk about Cameron Crowe. And it's like, Chris, we asked you one question. It's been 3 hours. No, but we've got to talk about Vanilla Sky. It does tie in with Matt Damon, Ben Affleck. And I love Good Will Hunting. So I appreciate you even mentioned it with The Limited in the same sentence.
Absolutely. The like I said, the how organic it is definitely works. The banter, it's just, you know, school. It seems like real friends, and I think that's something that you talked about with the chemistry and getting that. I think it's very interesting, you know, breaking them up into the three separate the groups of three and watching them talk. Very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Speaking of the limited, I did have another question on it, just because we talked about how professional it is and how everything kind of hits, and it's the first film that in your filmography of, right? We were wondering how old you were when you made that.
Yeah, I was, you know you're old when you have to think back to 2014. I was 23 or 22, 23. And it was the first time I'd made something for more than $200. And that was my first time going, I'm going to jump into film. I'm going to shoot this on film. And this is at a time where film was really nothing. Like Christopher Nolan and Tarantino had to storm over to Kodak and tell them we're not making films anymore unless you keep film alive. So it was around that time. Film was dead. Film was expensive. And it was nowhere to be found. And I said, no, fuck this. I want to shoot on film. And it needs to be this story. And I need... And also you're shooting it at a school with white walls. Shoot it on film. Don't shoot it on digital where it's going to look drab and depressing. Don't let the look of it tell you what the tone of the film is. So that was a big thing I was obsessed with. And I met the cinematographer, Kim Vedekus, where he was retired. He was retired and he was just teaching here and there. And I just met him and said, hey, can I make a film with you? Is that all right? You've shot on film before. Let's do it again. I'll put all my savings in. I don't care. And that's where it came from. And it just expanded from there.
That makes me feel great knowing how young you were when you were able to make that.
Thank you. It tells you that I haven't left school. That's what it says. Because I just left school and I'm like, oh, make a movie about school. It's like, Chris, you got to leave school. But yeah.
So we talked about, I do want to jump back a little bit to Audio Guide because we talked about.
Please do.
You mentioned that the limited, I think you said you shot in 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. So I was wondering with regards to Audio Guide, because I know that the original idea, for example, Lee told us was a one-page short that he had years before, and then he decided to develop it more when he spoke to you about it. But so I was wondering, once you got the script and you were set on, you were making that film, how long did it take until you were done with it at that point for Audio Guide?
Well, when I read the one page, I was like, all right, I'm making this. And he goes, oh, and I said, yeah, that's it. That's fine, because I love him as a writer. I think he's one of the best writers we have, and I don't think a lot of people know that, because he's known for his comedy, he's known for Bazura, which I love, but as a writer he's incredible, and he does the thing that I'm not great at, whereas he can write a plot and he can write a concept and really flesh out the concept without emphasizing character specifics. Like, he's one of the few that I trust to do that, whereas I then come in with the character with focusing on character, and that's why I think Audio Guide works at all. So with that, he wrote a seven-page draft of it, which had a few more things of the Audio Guide picking up wild scenarios about the world. And I was like, well, let's cut two or three, and in place of them, let's have more time with her. That's where that started. And then I did some of the rewrites where it's the woman coming out of the gallery with the domestic violence and her sitting in the park putting it on herself. That was me. And that also kind of came in close to shooting, because I'm like, I can't have this where she doesn't put it on herself early. Like, she needs to do that, because everyone in the audience is going to go, why hasn't she done that yet? I would have done that first. And I said that to Lee, and I said, Lee, with your permission, can I add a scene? It can just be, I'll just write a bit of a treatment. It doesn't have to be entirely in the script, but just somewhere where she's sitting down, looks at the device, maybe tries to crack it open or see what's weird about it on surface level, and then puts it on herself. That's it. And he agreed to that. And then I did add that in the script, but it was just a little description and just little things that I added with his permission and checked with him that it was okay, because it was the narrative that he built. So if I threw things in and he didn't like them, I think you would tell in the film. I think that would come across as clunky, weirdly to me. I don't know why. But so I did that. And then by the end, it was a 11-page script. So it went from 7 pages to 11, but the extra 4 pages were me just fleshing out little moments without dialogue where it's just her and what she would do and why she's doing them. So yeah, that's kind of where it came from.
So Audio Guide was recently released, but we've already mentioned that you've already gotten into your next film, which is Refused Classification. We already mentioned that it's not yet at festivals, but here at GDT, we did get a chance to watch it. So we would like to ask a couple spoiler-free questions, if that's all right.
Please. No one's seen it, so I'm excited to talk about it.
Awesome. So can we say that the basic premise is that it's about film ratings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So then the first question, just right off the bat, is what led to you wanting to make a film about that?
Yeah, sure. I've kind of weirdly been obsessed with film ratings my whole life. I don't know why. I think a lot of film people are obsessed with ratings and how they work. And I think it stems from, what are you going to cut? What am I going to watch that is, this isn't the original vision? What have you censored? What have you cut? And what are you not letting me see? And I think it came from, film censorship is censoring adults. It's not censoring children. And it's the idea that film censorship looks more at the consequences of real life actions, and real life things are more terrifying than things we see in films. The idea that when you watch an action film, if you shoot someone and there's no blood, it's PG. When there's blood, it's R, because that's the real world. That's consequences. That violence is now real, and that's, kids shouldn't see that. And I'm like, that's insane. You can't teach kids that shooting someone and there's no repercussions or there's nothing is fine. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was something I was obsessed with. And I was extremely obsessed for as long as I can remember about sexuality in film and what they will show and what they won't show, and how queer relationships were terrifying and kids shouldn't have seen it, whereas American Pie was okay. And nothing against American Pie, but just the idea of sexuality from the point of view of a straight male is what we were seeing. And that's the gaze that most sex scenes and most sexuality on screen was being shown. And things were looking same, and things were quite sleazy. And I'm like, why am I watching the same things? Like, sex should be wonderful on screen. Why is it not? And that's because rating, censorship and film ratings have made it so, I think. And then coming back to limited and going to an all-boys school, when I was looking into films and really learning about films, I was watching a lot of art house cinema and international cinema, and there was a lot of queer sex, and there was a lot of open sex, and people happy after having sex, and there were male bodies, there were female bodies. And in my head, I'm like, what if this wasn't restricted so much? Like, what if this wasn't restricted, and I showed this, and my friends saw this on a whim, and they weren't as homophobic, or they weren't as drawn back, or just terrified of sex, or it wasn't just the same gaze. What would those conversations look like? What would their perception of sex be in cinema? That's kind of where it stemmed from. Where I'm like, I'm going to an old boys' school. Their idea of sex and women and everything is just warped and bullshit. So what if they saw those art house films and they were allowed to see them, and they saw it and it was normal and it was grounded? Would they be more mature? Would it really open up their perception of people and other forms of sexuality? That's a big one. That's a big one where it came from. And the idea of the film came from, have you seen the film, This Film Is Not Yet Rated? It's a documentary about the MPAA. It's amazing. It's on YouTube. There's a story where Boys Don't Cry got an NC-17 or got an X or something to that effect. And the director was like, oh, okay, because there's rape and murder in the film. And they said, no, it's one scene in particular, and it's a woman having an orgasm. And she goes, what are you talking about? She goes, there's a scene where it's Hilary Swank dressed as a boy having sex with a woman. She's going down on her, and that woman's enjoying it. And it's a close-up of her smiling, and the music swells, and it's really wonderful. It's a really positive, wonderful scene. That got an NC-17. People getting shot and raped was fine. Then that same week, American Pie went up against it, and they got no cuts. They got zero cuts and zero notes. Not a problem. And that's when I was like, all right, we got to go back. I got to make something about this. I have to make a movie about this. And how do I do it without showing much? How can it just be through dialogue? The idea of, what if you show nothing and you can get an NC-17? What if words have the power to get a rating so high that only adults could see it? And even then it was censored. So yeah, that's where it came from.
So this might be an ignorant question, but in my understanding, I think that Australia has a separate rating system than the MPAA in America, but the one used in this film is the same one used as the MPAA. Is that a deliberate choice because of the size of the American box office and the recognizability I guess, of those of that rating system?
Yes, it's because the Australian rating system isn't that strict. It can be, but often it's quite open and liberal. And I had a few friends go, "Why didn't you mention the rating system in Australia?" And I said, "Because we get most of our films come from America, and when that film is censored in America, we don't get an uncensored cut. That film stays censored, like it's released and it's on DVD and it's censored." And it's the idea of that, if it's coming from that body and that body defines what that film ultimately becomes, then that's just going to be fed into how we perceive things and how everyone, because every Australian audiences in droves go watch an American film, not an Australian film, and they're going to watch that censored film. So it's all kind of in the same way going to be the same. Where both audiences are going to see the same film and have the same ideals and get told the same things. So that's one, the idea that what if a ratings body for one of the biggest countries in the world, or the biggest, you know, places where our media comes from, how that just affects everyone. That's one. And two, what if that system was in front of a different culture, like Australians? Because Australians fucking swear, and they are very, like, the word cunt in Australia is a warm term. And it's like you say, "Hey, my cunt," like that. It's very odd. And when Americans hear it, they're like, what are you saying? Don't call that poor person a cunt. I'm like, no, it's a term of endearment. That's the idea of what if you put that outdated body in front of a culture that's so open and liberal, and what does it look like, and how ridiculous does it sound, where you have different, yeah, so that's what I think.
It's interesting. It makes me think about not censorship by a like specific body, like the MPAA, but like other forms of censorship as well. So I'm sure you know this, but like China is rapidly becoming the biggest market for media and films in particular, but they have a government, like the MPAA, I don't think is government sponsored. I think it's like its own thing that like studios choose to affiliate with, but they have a government body, like a bureau to regulate films that come in. And so as a result of that, a lot of films end up getting censored either in the edit, like with the most recent Star Wars film that came out, they cut out a lesbian kiss so that it could be screened in China, or you have studios preemptively censoring themselves, like with the Top Gun sequel, where they took the Taiwan flag off of Tom Cruise's bomber jacket. Would that ever be something that you want to touch on and discuss?
Yes, but that sounds like it is, absolutely. And I love exploring that. The only problem with that is then I'd be going down a rabbit hole. And because that's a 4-hour documentary. Like that's right, what it would end up becoming. The idea of if you focus on sexuality, just even as a start, and it's one that hurt, like the idea of sexuality and queer relationships being shunned away in films, and that you couldn't have a throuple on screen. The fact that the most basic one is the one that's also the most hurtful for people, that's hurt communities and hurt representation. And that's why it was the focus of this, where it's like, no, you've hurt a lot of communities and a lot of people looking for representation who couldn't get it because it was offensive, but a man and a woman did it, it's fine. Whereas then going forward and even bigger than that, it's huge. There's so many different weird little things with different bodies and funding and censorship regulations. Here's an example as well. Austin Powers, the first film. Do you remember in the Austin Powers films when one of the henchmen gets killed and it cuts away to their families, which is probably the best joke in the whole film? That was cut in most countries. There's no cutaways. That's a thing. And I was like,
humanized the villain.
Yes. Yep. And then it made the violence more in a way like it had consequences to that violence. Even though it's a joke, it had consequences. That the violence had consequences, it had a repercussion. So it's like, nope. That I thought that was American. And then I find out it's not. It was, I think it was the UK. It was some country that picked that I didn't think was strict. And then that made me go, Jesus, there's always something everywhere, but it's the most ridiculous of things. None of it ever sounds rational to me. Do you know what I mean? Like any form of censorship never ever sounds rational or one that could protect a community more. It's just telling people what they can and can't see for no great reason, but yeah.
Yeah, the UK, I'm always surprised because you would think of them being very, you know, yeah. You think Europe and you think very like liberated, liberal kind of place, but then you look on like their actual history of censorship and it's pretty extensive. I mean, Clockwork Orange was banned for a really long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's astounding to me.
It's crazy. I don't get it. And that's the rabbit hole thing. I mean, looking at different bodies and what they will cut. And it's like, oh man, nah, this is too much. You'll see the next, if I ever do this again with you guys, it'll just be me with a gray beard and like my hair up. And it's like, Chris, how old are you? I'm 31. That's just me looking through censorship and getting old and like, oh yeah, it's a rabbit hole. And I'm like, no, stick to this for now because you'll go crazy and you'll change shit and you don't want to do that. So, yeah.
You talked about some of those smaller things that you wouldn't even think about, like the Austin Powers one, for example. I had to ask, because in the movie you mentioned that, for example, blood, if it's a different color, that helps with the family-friendly rating. And I thought that was very interesting. But something that really stuck out to me, and I have to ask if this is true, is... Mm-hmm. If you don't have a score, does that actually, that hurts the family friendly rating or?
Yep.
That's real. I had no idea.
Everything that you hear in all the little qualms that he says, all the little things that he says, they're all real. They're all from different films that got banned or got censored. I don't remember what that one was specifically, but that determines tone. It has to have a jokey thing behind it, a jokey score. To tell people that this is funny, don't take this seriously. When it's serious, then it's like, nope, this is a romance, this is bad. And the idea that anytime you watch a Hollywood film, especially from the late 80s, early 90s, where the side character is queer or gay or flamboyant, that's what that attitude comes from. It's like, no, it has to be funny. We'll accept it, but it has to be funny. It can't be serious. So yeah, that's unfortunately real. That's why that's that whole middle sequence, because it came from hearing about that with other films. And I'm like, Jesus, that's terrifying to me.
And I do want to just note that I don't want to be, we are trying to step around any spoilers. So if we say anything that's crossing a line, just let us know and we can always bleep it out / cut it out if we go too far with anything.
Honestly, I think we're okay to talk a couple of spoilery things. We can just say it now. If you have not seen the film that has not been released, mute some of this, like, but yeah, it's like I'm happy to talk about it openly with some spoilers. It's like it's good, so when people see it they might think more on it, so that's all good. I'm open.
Okay, thank you, I appreciate that.
Oh good.
I mean, I'm definitely excited for more people to get to see it, because I think a lot of people are kind of like aware of this but not conscious of it.
Yeah,
you know, they know that there's like an MPAA and ratings exist and are a thing, but I don't think they realize the extent to which it can really stifle creativity. And especially with the push for what you were talking about earlier, representation becoming more and more of a not an issue of the day, because it's actually genuinely very important, but coming more and more to the forefront. With representation coming more and more to the forefront, I think people really need to see this and think about it and talk about it. And I think if we could, you know, kind of, hey, GDT audience, blow this up and get this seen when it's released more and more, maybe we can affect some change. Because I completely agree with you and kind of the thesis of your film that it's just very, very harmful to the creative process and to marginalized groups.
Yeah. And attitudes as well. I agree with you. Thank you for saying that. It's also attitudes. Again, going to a Catholic all boys school and seeing how those guys, even after leaving school, were talking about women and queer relationships in film. And here's one. Brokeback Mountain came out when I was in year 8 or 9 at a Catholic all boys school. And it was joke after joke after joke. No guy would see it. Oh, don't watch that. It's gross. And I'm like, man, imagine if that was just PG-13, or if it was more in films, if they saw it more in the films that they were consuming, and it just would have been a romance that they maybe saw. It's just that idea of defining those attitudes and the films and how we could have had this sooner. We could have had this in the 90s. We could have had this in the 80s. And it's just like, no, it's up until now, there's been no real change. Like the things that are mentioned in the film, haven't changed. Like a lot of them haven't. And it's this system has been in place for over for about 50 years. So, yeah.
Long enough, maybe longer than that, because I believe that Psycho was the first film to ever show a toilet being flushed on camera, because that was considered obscene, and like Hitchcock had to really go and like fight for that scene being allowed in the film, which is, you know, crazy to think about now. But I can see that maybe, hopefully, if we have a generation of activists and filmmakers who are really continually pushing the boundaries and doing things to change attitudes and norms, hopefully the things that are censored in films today, 70 years from now, will be looked at as ludicrous.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's also the thing of, like, why can't they change? Why not? And it's also, it all comes down to a built-in prejudice. It does, because it's just insane to me that there isn't a great reason for it. There never has been for the small things that they're censoring. And I'm with you on that. I think the censorship's been in place for 100 years, I'm sure, around that. But the MPAA itself, I think, was set around started around the 50, 60 year mark. But yeah, my time, the history of it, I'm a little bit fuzzy on, which I should be better at now that this is coming out and I have to talk about it. But I'm with you. It's insane. That's where it came from, making a 13 minute movie out of it, because I just love cramming things into 13 minutes and not actually telling it that I'm feature length.
I do think this story itself lends itself beautifully to maybe the shorter time frame as well. I do want to ask about the story, because obviously we've talked about how it's about film ratings, but it's also got a film at its center of it, right? And I think that what makes a lot of it very interesting is how the dynamic that you're seeing be played out between the three main characters plays into the film ratings. So I was wondering if from the get-go, was it always going to be based on these three people that were in an open relationship? Or was that something that came later on in the process of writing it?
Yeah, of course. The first idea of this came about 10 years ago, where it was two women in a room. This was the original idea, and this is why I was like, don't write anything for 10 years. It started with two women in a room, and they were meeting each other for the first time, and they were having a conversation. And then we slowly learned that it's a relationship, that they're on a date. And then they kiss each other, and just in a really organic way. It's meant to be about a 5-minute scene. And then you hear a noise in the corner of the room under a pile of clothes. And then the woman whose house it is takes the pile of clothes off, and it's one of the censors from the MPAA, because that woman is a director and her film got an X for having two women kiss. And then she then goes to him, hey, so you just saw that. Was that too forceful? Was that too violent? Maybe if I shot her, would that be a PG instead? Or I don't know, how should the date go? And it was that. And I'm like, this is a silly revenge film. Do not do that. Wait, keep this idea in mind. And then there was a couple that I met and I became very good friends with, Bradford and Angela, who Bradford's now one of the writers, and he really made the film sing. But they're bisexual and they're polyamorous. And they just had this beautiful thing going. And I was like, why haven't I seen this in films? And then it was inspired by a film that I saw called Professor Marsden and the Wonder Women. Have you guys seen that? It's an incredible film that no one saw, no one. And it's about the guy who invented Wonder Woman. And he was in a relationship with two women, and how a lot of Wonder Woman's origins and her story came from bisexuality, bisexual culture, BDSM, and just having an open mind to sexuality. And he also invented the lie detector test. This film's amazing, and no one saw it, and it was buried on release. And I'm like, okay, so this, the one time that this should have been the forefront, this could have been groundbreaking for polyamorous relationships and bisexuality as well, which has always been a gray area in films. And I think with people as well, and I think films should explore it more. I was like, I can't do it. I need to make this film. And I showed Bradford and Angela the Professor Marsden. And I said, well, hey, I've got this idea. Let's collaborate on it. I've written the first few drafts. The drafts aren't great. Get in there and really make those characters sing. Make the man's the censor guys. make his dialogue more formal, more nitpicky, more like it's a person who's unaware that he's part of a system and he's more just an individual watching a movie and thinking that these are problems when they're not. And yeah, and that's where it came from. And he really made, and that's something with collaboration where he really made that those characters go, I hope, above the concept and just make it, you know, more grounded and more of a lived experience too, which I didn't have. And I wanted him there. And yeah, so that's where it came from.
We've talked about straddling lines of genre before for some of your other films. And this one, I think, is less so like, is it a horror? Is it a sci-fi? It's obviously not either of those. But what it is it's got humor. It's got moments that are definitely very funny. And
yeah,
so does Audio Guide. And I don't know if we really mentioned that before, but Audio Guide also has moments that are funny. So I was wondering if that's something that you like to do on purpose, if you inject it in there, or if it's something that kind of organically comes. I don't know, like in your process, is that something that you're, are you trying to be funny?
Look, the honest, intentionally, well, initially, no. But there is a thing where everything I say and do is a joke. And that's just who I am as a person. And I've always done that. And here I am trying to make serious cinema. And I'm like, don't lie to people. Just have scenes where people say something absolutely silly or have a moment that's silly. And the idea that if it's a drama, those jokes will land better instead of it just being a straight comedy where you're waiting for laughs and you're waiting for jokes. Have it where people will say, and also I think it's a thing with people and it's not in characters a lot in films where they will make a joke in a straight at a strange moment because they're still processing what that is. And even a film can do it too. And I think that's a very organic human thing to make a joke or say something silly out of not knowing how to process something or not knowing how you feel about it. Like that idea of it's more of a defense mechanism. And I love that. And I love putting that in there. And also the idea of if you're watching something serious, it needs to have something funny. It needs to have people who are funny and make you laugh. And that also is something I've always known. If you can make someone laugh in meeting them, you've already got 25% more of their trust or more of them liking you. Or laughing is a very like communal warm thing, or just telling a joke. So I like that. And that's something that I've just both injected and both that's come organic where I'm like, oh no, this is a serious moment. Oh man, leave it in there. It's funny. And with this specifically, this is something that I have argued with Bradford, the writer, where he wanted it to just be a comedy. And I'm like, we can't have it just be a comedy only because you do lose some of those character, and Bradford's agreed with this too, but it's just more like those, the three people on the couch, you do lose some of the shared feeling of defeat and that shared feeling of fuck, this is hopeless. Holy shit. I can't just be in love with you. I have to shoot you in order for people to see us. That there needs to be that sort of serious tone throughout it. And also the idea that those jokes will land a little better. And also these people are funny. Like they're not just, oh no, we have got an R, that is terrible. They're gonna tell the guy to go fuck himself. Like that's what people would do, especially Australians. Australians will throw a bottle at that man. If this were an Australian pub, that man would last 8 seconds. The film would get an X and there'd be bottles thrown at him, they call him a cunt. So yeah, it was more just the minute there's little jokes in there and there's moments where people swear and little things like that is more organic to me and it feels more of like a shared experience. So yeah, I love that they're in there, but it's a bit of both, intentional and organic.
And I wouldn't say that it takes away from the seriousness of it. So it's just more of like, there's moments of surrealness that that are not like humorous in the, I guess the general sense of the word, but more so in a way where it's like, oh, I can't believe this is happening right now. Or I can't believe this character just said what they said. That can lend to some, it's humor, but it's like, again, it's not like a joke being told, but what happens in this film, I think is it's a really good use of the curses. And that's, there's moments that a character will say something and you'll just be like, okay, that was the perfect time to say what they just said right there. And it really just, and again, it doesn't take away from, because like you said, you're actually trying to explore the censorship and stuff of it, right? You're trying to, it's not a documentary, but you are trying to shed some light on that. And like you said, it would be nice to move away from some of the censorship eventually. But so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take away from any of that. But I just wanted to comment on the, I think like you've kind of mentioned it, that Australians know how to use curse words. It definitely shows in this this film, I think. Very, very good timing.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate that. That was one of my biggest worries. That, hey, I watched this really thoughtful film about censorship. Too bad all the characters kept calling him a cunt and it was 5 minutes long. And I'm like, oh, that's not good. So yeah, thank you for saying that.
So a general question about your films. They each kind of stand out from one another and they touch on a wide array of subject matter. Is there a subject that you really want to tackle for a future endeavor? Is there something that you kind of haven't gotten to wet your beak on yet?
Yep. Well, the feature that I'm working on is another dream project sort of thing. It's about, and it's what all old filmmakers are now, not old, but all filmmakers are now looking at, nostalgia. That's the one I want to look at next, which is not, it's not a theme that we're tackling necessarily, but there'll be stuff in there. But yeah, no, the idea of nostalgia, that's the one I'm making next. And it does have a kind of high concept, kind of. But if you've seen my other stuff, there, nothing wild happens. But it's, yeah, it's that's the next one. Just a film about nostalgia and juggling tones within that and a bit of a concept. Yeah.
Oh, boy, do I have a short film that I want to pitch to you. Talking about nostalgia.
Yeah. Oh, I love them. Oh, send them my way. I love hearing about them. Yeah. Nostalgia is the one. I'm obsessed with movies capturing nostalgia. And I think a lot of them do a really good job. I'm like, let's keep going. There's some good stuff there. I think Trainspotting 2 is one of the best examples. I think one of the best movies of the decade. Not too many people saw it, but yeah.
It's interesting that we've actually talked to one of our questions was going to be about transitioning, you know, trying to make a feature film after having made a bunch of short films, especially because we talked to Tim Egan. He said that when you have a successful short film, you get, everyone asks, you know, what's your pitch for it as a feature, which you got with Audio Guide, right? Which is, again, very funny that, you know, people want a feature-length film of something that started off as a one-minute script.
Yeah.
But so you do want to transition into trying to make feature films. Do you see yourself continuing to make short films as well?
Yes. And it comes down to, I love the idea of telling a story in 10 minutes. And 15 minutes, and it's not easy to do, I don't think. Well, and I do have a thing with short films that if it doesn't have a story or it doesn't have a purpose other than a concept and a punchline, I struggle with it. Like, it's the idea of, that's only 10 minutes, so we'll just have a funny setup and then there's a punchline at the end. I'm like, no, tell a movie, make it feel like a little feature. And I like doing that. I like kind of getting, I like using short films as a way to perfect character and storytelling and the marriage of concepts and people. And also writing a feature and making a feature is really hard. And I've never dealt with a funding body. This has all just been me funding my own stuff. So the idea that I could make little short films and keep making movies with my own money is really nice. And then looking hopefully for other funds and other ways to do it with a feature would be good. So, and also shooting on film's not cheap. So to do it with shooting on film's not cheap. So to do it with a short film I can do with a feature, I don't know if I can get away with it. I'm trying.
Maybe these laps of awards and winning these festivals will get you bolstered up a little bit, you know?
I hope so. If I go into those meetings, let's talk Audio Guide, the feature. I'm like, no, I have a nice little feature about nostalgia. Like, we want the iPod. I'm like, oh, no. So we'll see.
Well, we've got our fingers crossed for you over here.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that, guys.
So I know that we've taken up a lot of your time already, but we do have a question that we kind of like to ask everyone. It's one of our final questions where we like to ask, is there a filmmaker that you think we should check out that we may not have already heard of? Maybe an independent filmmaker or someone that maybe you even know personally? Anything that kind of comes to your mind that our audience and we should both check out, look into their films?
Yeah, of course. So I will start off that I recommend people look up Tim Egan and Lee Zachariah, your past two guests. And it's not because Tim Egan did the color grading and the visual effects on Refused, which I'm sure you noticed, and Lee wrote Audio Guide, but there's a really beautiful filmmaker scene in Melbourne in Australia, because I don't know a lot of filmmakers in Sydney and they're all from Melbourne, and I knew them through Twitter and just common film people. And then I just was like, no, I love you guys. I want to get into that scene. So I think checking out their work, Lee Zachariah, his show, Bizarro Project, Tim Egan, Curve, and the one he's hopefully making next, which I'm messaging him daily going, where's Curve 2? He goes, I'm not making Curve 2. I'm making a short. I'm like, hurry up. I want another Tim Egan film. Them. I think Paul Anthony Nelson is also part of that, is a filmmaker from the Melbourne film scene. He's made two features and a few shorts. His first feature is called Trench, which I think is on Amazon Prime over there. And if you can find the film Trench, it's a low budget feature film, which I think is a really sweet idea, and it executes some ideas really well. And it's a film noir shot in 2017 in black and white. And I'm like, no, it's good. It's got a very specific feel to it, which I think is great. And he's just made a horror film called Apparitions, which is apparently a masterpiece. So I'm waiting to see that. But I recommend Paul Anthony Nelson. There's another filmmaker called Alison Chaum, who I absolutely love. And she's based in Adelaide, and she makes 15-minute short films, some a little longer, about her family history, and they don't have a lot of dialogue, and they're all about being in a moment in a certain milieu and a certain specific feeling, which with her films just really transports me, and I think they're quite beautiful. And who else? Mia Kate Russell, who Tim mentioned as his pick. She's great. Her films give me nightmares. When you meet her, she's lovely. And I'm like, well, you know I'm going to send you the bills from my therapy sessions. And she goes, why? And I'm like, don't act like that. I've seen your films. When you meet her and you watch Maggie May, and then you meet her again, she's like, what did you think of my film? And I'm just like, it was interesting. Like, I think her stuff is great. And I love Mia Kate, how she's obsessed with the ugly of things. She's really obsessed with the ugliness of situations and the gross human behavior, and the absolute opposite of the MPAA. She likes seeing blood and guts, and she likes seeing people do disgusting things. And I think she's great. And yeah, I think they're my big picks for now. I'm sure there's filmmakers I'll have to apologize to after this, but yeah, they're really good.
I absolutely can't wait to watch Trench. And for any of the audience who hasn't already been swayed on this, definitely check out Maggie May and Liz Drives by Mia Kate Russell, because they're one of our favorite words on this podcast is visceral, and mm-hmm. visceral is one of the best ways to describe those films. They're some of my viscerally favorite
horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, she's the loveliest person. So it really throws you off when you meet her and you're like, what a nice lady. I'll just go, oh. And then you meet, and yeah, it's she's great. I think she's cool.
And Mia Kate, if you're listening to this, please come on. Come on the pod.
Yeah. Yeah, Mia. Hurry up. Don't worry, I'll talk to you. You can make a horror film about it where everyone gets murdered after the podcast. But just go on the podcast and we'll talk. See ya. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's a very vibrant Australian film scene, and a lot of filmmakers who just haven't had a light shine on them. And I think a lot of them are from Melbourne. Like I know a lot of Melbourne filmmakers more than I do Sydney ones. But yeah, I think they're all great. And I'm excited for what Tim and Lee even do next, and Mia and Alison. So that they're great. And Paul Anthony Nelson, his new feature. So that's called Apparition. So that might be going to the US soon as well, which I've heard that's great.
Very excited to watch all of those, to learn about that. We've had such a fun time kind of delving into the Australian film scene. I know I don't like speaking for my co-hosts, but I know we've had a lot of fun just being able to, you know, this interview today has been amazing talking to you about it. And it's like, it's this whole world that people aren't necessarily privy to. And it's kind of, it's always great to get more attention onto these filmmakers who are, like you said, making just crazy good work.
Yeah. Like really talented. I don't know. I know that it's not like we're like stumbling upon, it's not like, you know, we're like Christopher Columbus discovering like the new world that, you know, is already there, you know, this little seed already existed. But for us to like come to it and find something new and refreshing is just like so exciting. And then to be able to talk to these extremely talented filmmakers like yourself and like Tim and Glenn and Lee and everyone that we've talked to has just been an absolute joy. And I hope our audience has felt that as well.
Oh, thank you guys. No, I've shared the Lee and Tim episode, so I've got to go out there and share the others as well, and this one, because you guys ask amazing questions. And I love that you're really looking into us and these filmmakers' works. Like, they wouldn't be shown otherwise. And if they don't do a good festival run, no one sees them. So it means a lot. Like, you guys are really doing great work just getting that stuff out there. It's easy for a film just to be buried. I'll say that much. Like, it's easy just to spend a year or two on something and then no one sees it. So, yeah, I appreciate what you guys do, and I love your questions. So it means a lot to us.
Thank you. I mean, we appreciate the kind words.
And thank you so much for coming on and making the time.
Oh, of course.
We really appreciate it.
No. And thank you for the kind words on the films and all your observations. Like, they really mean a lot. Like, again, no one saw The Limited, and a lot of people may not see Refused. So this is really, it means a lot to me. So I appreciate it, guys.
So the links to listen to all
come back anytime.
Yes.
Thank you.
I was definitely gladly. We're gonna need to have you back on the podcast someday. So I hope that I don't bother you too much with my when I message you about that.
No, do it, man. Do it next week. It's like, so Refused, which you've seen 5 times now. Yes, let's talk about it again, guys. So no, absolutely. I'm very excited.
So the link to watch all of Chris's work will be in the podcast description notes. Obviously, Refused classification will not be out yet, so we won't be able to link that to you guys yet, but we will be posting about it as soon as it is available. So I'm sure that you'll be posting about that on Twitter, and we'll be reposting it as well.
When is that slated to have a wider release or to be unlocked on the Vimeo?
Refused? Look, festival runs are about 2 years, which sucks because I want everyone to see this. But it is at this, from this point on, it's about 2 years. We do have a world premiere coming up in Sydney this weekend, but we only just got a poster release. So I'm hoping to get a trailer out there, and anyone who's interested in the film or wanting to see bits of it or talk about it, like, absolutely message me. One thing about filmmakers, I love when they're just open to talk to anyone about the work. And so, yeah, I'm always down to talk about the film, even if I can't show you just yet. Hopefully we'll have some festivals lined up.
Fantastic. That's good to hear.
Awesome.
Thank you again for everything. We really do appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely, guys. Thank you again. And thank you for going back and watching all the films. That means a lot. So, and I'm so glad you guys enjoy them. That's the big thing. You make stuff for it to be enjoyed. And also comments about shooting on film and stuff, because that's something that's never been that easy to acquire and to do. So to hear that it's going somewhere means a lot.
I was going to say, you don't have to thank us for watching it, because it was definitely enjoyable to see that. I know, like, I'm echoing Tarin's kind of that what the fuck feeling the first time you watched The Limited. Okay, so that's what they're saying. Okay, yeah, I got it. And the feeling that you're able to get in all of your films is amazing. So thank you.
That means a lot. My partner, before I went on, she goes, are you going to warn them about The Limited if they watch it? And I'm like, they're not going to watch The Limited. They watch Audio Guy and we have a nice chat. And then it opens, so The Limited. Man, those guys suck. I'm like, oh. one little funny thing, just because we're talking about Limited and I haven't talked about it in so long. When it first premiered, a lot of my friends were there. And when it ended, they're like, you didn't have a good time at school. That was rough. And a 85-year-old woman after the film said, that was great. You really got into how boys talk. And I'm like, okay, she saw the wrong film. Thank you, sweetie. And then she was talking about it. I'm like, oh man, you just never know who's going to like it. But yeah, thank you guys. No, that it really helped. Really means a lot.
That's all right. I actually do have one last question about The Limited since we came back to it. And do I don't it, know man. If I'm missing something, but the title, like, where does that relate?
Yeah, cool. So
what we're seeing on screen.
Thank you for asking that. Okay, so The Limited, it was initially, it was from a scene that I cut where, well, no, I can, okay, I can tie this in better. The scene where the guy goes, you know, I'm not an idiot, right? And he goes, you know, I know things. I'm quite smart. And he goes, you don't, but that's good. Like, that's a good thing. That's where it's from. It's the idea of someone having a limited, either having limited knowledge and limited smarts, but just more so in particular with this film, a limited capacity for other people's feelings and other, it's just kind of like an all round, just the way that young boys just have it, that are just limited in their worldview and how they perceive things and how they talk like, about people and their knowledge. And yeah.
Blissful ignorance. And like, yeah, you're just unaware of, you know, the impact that you're having or whatever it is that you're doing.
Exactly. And just how words hurt, like how cutting those words can be. But yeah, that's 16-year-old boys. They're limited. Like, they can be. Not all are like that.
Absolutely.
I went to going to that school. Like, I'm going to make a horror film about it one day, and you'll know, like, oh man, that limited guy never let that go. But yeah. 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 Thank you for asking. I appreciate that.
So thank you again for everything. Yeah. I know we've kind of wrapped up a couple of times, but we keep bringing you back in with, we keep reeling you in with another question.
Yeah. That would have burned me if I didn't actually find that out, because I, yeah.
Thank you.
But that makes a ton of sense. Yeah.
Thank you for asking. No one's asked it. They said, yeah, limited. It's surely about a deleted scene. I'm like, no, it's in the film, but yeah. So thanks. And yeah, any questions you have, I always love answering them. So it's meant a lot. But yeah. Thank you guys. It's been great.
And we've got you now on, we've got evidence of you saying that you're going to come back on. So we're going to have to hold you to it. So, you know, you've already dug your grave there.
Dug my grave. I'm going to message you in 2 weeks going, I forgot to talk about Rich Southland Tales. Let's go on again. It's like, man, I'm not doing that.
Keep your DMs open for sure.
Done. Very excited, guys. That's awesome.
So there you have it. That was our interview with Chris Alina. Now you know why we were saying it was so good, because it was. We know you loved it. Thank you for listening. Thank you again to Chris for being such an amazing guest and for all of his answers and for just being one of the homies, apparently.
Yeah, Chris, you're the fucking man. Please come back on, you know, basically whenever you want. We will have you. We had so much fun talking to you.
Yes, we definitely want you back on, Chris. So we're going to be bothering you as soon as we can about that. Once Refused Classification is out, we definitely want to talk to you about that once wide audiences can see it. I know we did a little bit of talk about it, but we're definitely going to need to get you back in the booth, back talking about more. It was great. Thank you. Next week, we will have another interview. We're going to be talking to Christopher Soren Kelly about his work, including his feature film, The Tangle. The Tangle is available to watch online right now on Amazon Prime. So watch that before next week's episode, because we will again be spoiling the shit out of that. So definitely want to watch that before the interview. So stay tuned for that. It'll be releasing next Friday.
Absolutely. Stay tuned. That's another really fun one. Another really deep one with some really, really great answers. We are so lucky to be able to pick all these directors' brains. And we learn so much, and we hope you are too. Thank you for listening.
Next Friday, The Tangle. See y'all then.